Talk Radio.
Finding the document that he's going to talk about tonight. So I thought while we're waiting, we're going to take her by surprise. And we have a caller who's listening in. Hello.
Hey, how are you?
I'm great. I just thought that we just start out asking you. Tonight, Steve is talking about using fear to control society. And
oh, boy.
Yeah. So I just wanted to ask maybe a couple of the fears that you have. And Steve, I'm just getting a couple comments before we start. I see that you made it.
Yeah, I'm good. He's here. I really don't know what to say. I just called to listen in.
And you have no fears?
Not this kind of thing. I was calling in just to support you, sweetie.
Okay, I have fears. So I'm surprised. Okay.
I have a fear Romney will get elected. That's probably my biggest one.
Okay.
And I have a fear we'll have hail tonight because we're having a hellacious storm, but that's about it.
Okay.
You won't have to worry about Romney, I can tell you that.
Climate.
I'm sorry?
You won't have to worry about Romney. He's not going to get in.
No, put your mouth to the goddess's ear, I'll tell you.
Well, hoping, yeah. So, okay, we'll just put you back on mute, Ben.
All right, thanks.
Thank you. Hello, Steve.
Hey there, how are you?
I said that you were searching out a last-minute document. Now, this is Steve McManus from ForbiddenAmerica.com.
Yes.
You have a show on Saturday night, am I right?
Saturday nights at 11 p.m. Eastern in the United States. We do a show once a week, which covers, well, my co-host and I. My co-host is Joseph Peterson. He's the one of the inceptors of truthisscary.com. And despite the name, their motto is, don't be afraid, be aware. And so that really fit in well with my, you know, my whole paradigm that I'm inside of, the ethos that I believe in, and, you know, what I'm trying to achieve is that you need to know some things that otherwise you're not going to know. And the reason you need to know them is so that when things start to look really scary, you'll have the inside track and you'll know what's going on. You don't have to be afraid. You'll know what to do, and that's the basis for the programming.
Exactly, which makes a lot of sense. I mean, people have all kinds of fears, from fears of getting old to not getting in the college they want to all types of things like that. But when it comes down to politics, climate change, all of this, it starts to get a little freakier. So... I agree.
That's the thing. There are things to be afraid of. I mean, you know, we're afraid of certain things. When you see, like, Fukushima, well, who wouldn't be afraid of that, you know, of course.
Right.
But, back in the day when folks like you and I were boomers, you know, and here we all are in our 40s, 50s, 60s, and what are we afraid of? We used to be afraid of one thing only, aside from, you know, messing with our parents, which was the bomb.
They're red.
You were afraid of the bomb.
Soviets.
Yeah, the Soviets and their bomb. That was all you were afraid of. You would duck and cover under your desk. There was only the only thing that you had to be afraid of in terms of what the government was telling you. That was it, the bomb. That was the best they could do. And so...
Right. Because, well, we knew that our government was on our side, right? So we weren't afraid of our own government.
The less you question anything, the more you think the authoritarian figures are on your side.
Yes.
Okay.
You put it
because
specifically right there. Yeah.
If your sense of reality is that, why would I ever question this, that, or the other thing? I mean, it's all been handled for me. I'll just do what I'm told. Well, if you're comfortable there and you can't foresee ever going outside those lines, then... Why would you need to be afraid? Someone's handling it for you.
Yep.
And, I mean, you know what I mean?
Yeah, even though we know better, but sure. And we always think that they, whoever they are, in the government or corporations, whatever, they are more informed and they know more about it.
Well, there's two scenarios there, right there. Okay, one is everyone thinks that, especially in the 70s, a big thing in Hollywood, which is, you know, unfortunately one of the prime suppliers of public sentiment, is that in the 70s, movies were very popular that said, or that had the message that the government is pretty much all-knowing,
mm-hmm.
and that there are black ops all around you. There are people who are invisible or, you know, they're mysterious and shady, and they have goods on you. They have the ability to spy on your every move, which in the 70s was, like, freaking impossible, all right? You know, the best they could do back then was COINTELPRO, which was, you know, telephone wiretapping, and even that was a very arduous task in those days for them to actually accomplish it without involving lots of people. Well, they didn't know everything about you. They hardly knew anything at all about you, but they wanted you to think, like, I better not screw up, but they're watching me.
Yeah.
And that really took hold. And in the 80s, that really took hold, and people were, you know, like, well, you know, we can't put our kids in the front yard. Someone's going to take them. And they really, you know, you had the McMartin preschool case. You had this case. You had that case. You couldn't leave your kids outside because there's pedophiles freaking everywhere. Okay?
Yeah.
I mean, really, folks? Really? I mean, suddenly in the 1980s, like, pedophiles just sprang into action? I mean, come on. You know, so that you were afraid of that. And then you were afraid of the Tylenol scare, and you were afraid of this and that and the other thing. They taught you piece by piece to be afraid. Now, some of it was done on purpose from, you know, positions of authority, people that were sitting around in boardrooms or sitting around in whatever room, and saying, how do we make them afraid so that we can get them to cooperate? And some of it was done all too willingly by the people like you and I, the guy that figured out, you know what, if I, because there's no way for them to know I did it, I'll just slip some cyanide into the Tylenol. Wow, I really get those bastards. And once that happens, then the people will take that horrible situation and they'll capitalize on it. And they'll say, did you see that? You want to copy that? They'll say, did you see that? You can't take Tylenol anymore. It's cyanide now. And
right.
There are people today,
and we can make
this day, they won't take Tylenol.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, I mean, you can't – is that realism? Like, you can't take Tylenol to this day because somebody did that once? No.
No.
Tylenol's as safe as anything else. I mean, I'm not going to get into the whole big pharma thing, but
right.
You know, it's no more dangerous than any other drug. I mean, you go ahead and take it. It's not going to hurt you. And the thing is that people will say, oh, well, you know, maybe it taught us something. Maybe it gave us the benefit of saying, well, listen, if we fix all these wrappers, if we fix all these containers, right, then we're safer. And everybody got into that mindset. Well, wait a minute. If our government, like the FDA, because that's part of the government, if they took measures to make us safer, well, that's awesome. And then it was this government agency did this, and we're even safer still. And, oh, look at that. We had a hijacking. Well, you know, I don't know if you remember the 70s, but there was a shitload of hijackings in the 70s. And Red Brigades and all these different things were happening. And the thing is, we had guys that could deal with that, and we did deal with it. And warrants were served back in the day.
Yeah.
And it only took two guys. You go up to a house, you knock on the door, maybe there was trouble, maybe there wasn't, but you could serve a warrant, and it wasn't any big deal. And nowadays, you got a 12-man squad, SWAT team, fully militarized with M4 machine guns that are, you know, picking a battering ram and kicking in your door because they think behind every single door is a machine gun. And that's how they serve a warrant today, as opposed to, you know, the Cato Institute even talked about how the militarization of the police
is indirect. This whole population thing, I think just with more people, we have so many more people now.
And we do.
So things are multiplied.
Well, let's look at it this way. Let's look at the number of people. Look at all the people in the United States. Now, we have over 315 million people. We have more than that. It's gone past that, okay? We have a lot of people, more than we did. In the 70s, it was like, what, 185 million, and now it's like, you know, more than
maybe.
Double.
It has just jumped so much, so
yeah.
fast.
But, okay, let's take that into account. Oh, my God, we got so many people, so much crime. No, there's less crime. Per capita, there's less crime. And, you know, this thing about overpopulation, there is data to support that there are areas that are overpopulated, but globally, it evens out. Now, the problem is that in certain areas, it is so bad that it can create a problem which has a cascading effect on other parts of the environment. So, yes, there are those, you know, there is validity to the statistics that show if you have a lot of people, the statistics are the same as they are for studies on certain types of animals. That says when you put too many animals in the same confined area, then they start eating each other, attacking each other indiscriminately, raping each other. The same thing that people do. Okay, you can't stack them in too tight because they go nuts. So that is true.
I'm not sure. There's a little echo behind you or somebody talking maybe.
That's okay. I'm on the move and I'm amongst people going back and forth, so we'll try to keep that to a minimum. But, yeah, so, I mean...
But I was just saying that back then they didn't have... And I know what you're saying, but I just want to make clear that everybody didn't... Not that everybody now has an automatic weapon or semi-automatic at their home, but... And
right.
I think that this whole thing of 10 people in a SWAT unit to... You know, get some 17-year-old kid that maybe did something, maybe just is a little overkill, but they're so gung-ho.
Right.
Whatever it is they're teaching them. But there again, they have a fear.
Are there times when we need those guys? Well, of course there are. Is there a guy that, you know, if you go to try to serve that warrant and then you realize that, holy shit, we got a problem.
Yeah.
Then you call those guys in.
Right.
And they're needed.
But they use that to instill fear in all of us. So, if you see that happen to your neighbor's house and they totally wreck it for no apparent reason, you know, you may just be a little less likely to call for help.
Mm-hmm.
When you think that,
but
you know, something's happened.
Yeah, that is actually true. There are less people that actually make that call now.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, like, the psychology behind it, okay, now, remember that these are just regular people that work in police departments. Now, let's also make the point that we need to make this point because it's vital, that the vast majority of people working in law enforcement are just regular people. They're your neighbors, and they have a job. And let's face it, folks, it's a shitty job, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And they only see the worst of everything every day, and they still have to try to keep a good attitude. So that's tough right there already.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. And most of them are not your problem. And even the fact of the ones that are the problem, as we see it, as we can discuss, it's because their training, their psychology is when they train these SWAT teams to go into these places, now it's a given that municipalities and counties operate under the basis that they are immune from litigation.
Right.
They are not immune from prosecution, but they are immune from litigation. You would have to screw up so blatantly and so bad to get prosecuted that it would be truly egregious. But they don't generally get prosecuted. They don't generally get found to be culpable in any of these, you know, what anyone else would do is a crime. For instance, there's a case that just happened quite recently where they assaulted the wrong house. They assaulted people that had done nothing, okay?
Right.
Now, this is not unheard of. It does happen. And they went in there, and they did their usual tactics. Now, the psychology that's at work here is that they need to get in there and do their job, survive, not get shot, get the person they're after, and then get out. Well, the problem with that is that their psychology that they're trained to employ is that you can operate here with impunity. Go in there, get this job done, and let's get out, and don't take any shit off anybody. And the reason for that is they're trying to survive. They're scared.
Yeah.
These men are scared. Okay, they don't want to admit to that. But fear is very much a part of that job. It's self-preservation. I don't blame them. I'd want to go home too, you know?
Sure.
So they go in there, and it's like, shut up! And they're like, everybody down! And it's like, these people haven't done anything. Now, is it wrong for them to have to go through that? Well, of course it is. It's travesty. However, that's the training they've been given. And even if they've been determined to be in the wrong place, the squad will still operate in such a manner as to maintain absolute control. You can't shut that shit off. They have to continue to operate that way. Well, the problem with one of the most recent cases we heard of is that they, in fact, had tied children up. You know, they zip-cuffed them or whatever they did. That's what I mean. And which is that standard procedure, everybody gets immobilized so that there are no threats. Now, everybody can say, what do you mean threats? They're just kids. But in the psychology that we're dealing with, everybody's a threat. This is their training. You have to assume that anybody could swing around on you with a steak knife or whatever. Everybody's a threat. So they've been trained. Again, it's fear. And so they tied the kids up, and then they ended up as it's becoming more of an apparent trend that when they arrive at the scene, SWAT team or no SWAT team, if there's a loose dog who they consider to be a threat, the immediate reaction is to shoot the dog.
Yeah.
And they shot the dog in front of the kids. And they left the dog right there in front of the kids while they were sitting there on the floor crying. And because of the stress of the moment and all these men running around this apartment with their automatic weapons and their gas masks and all this stuff, you know, like, you know, clear, bedroom, clear, and all this kind of stuff. And the kids were crying and screaming, and people were telling the kids, shut up, because they were under stress. Now, this is a horrific scene. This is a horrific scene, okay? And they're in the wrong house. Now, this type of stuff probably wouldn't happen if, in fact, as the Cato Institute pointed out, that posse comitatus, which is a law that had been enacted after the Civil War, that was supposed to be, you know, you weren't supposed to be able to circumvent the law by any means. Posse comitatus said that you could not militarize the secular, local, non-military police.
Mm.
They were the county sheriff or the police department or any of that stuff that were not military. They could not be militarized. And the reasoning behind that was because during the Civil War, there were basically no police. It was just soldiers. And they would come into your house if they damn well felt like it. And there were horrible abuses, as you can imagine, many of which has been documented.
Yeah.
So that law was written that said, no more. This will never happen again on our soil. This is never, ever to be repeated. This, the things that we have seen to have happened are so horrible that we cannot ever let this happen on our soil again. So Posse Comitatus was enacted. Except that there was a huge acceleration during Bush 1, Reagan, Bush 1, and a little bit after that during Clinton. It had nothing to do with left or right. It was administrative. It was, you had the executive branch, you had the legislative branch, and you had the judiciary branch, all three working together. And basically they eroded one piece of legislation after another, ba-boom, 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 piece by piece. Posse Comitatus was dismantled, and you had now full and clear clearance, green light was given so that you had full capability legally to militarize your local police to the point now where, and I'm not kidding, you have the ability by police departments to simply contact the federal government and say, we would like a pain array weapon. We would like, that's the microwave weapon that makes you feel like you're standing inside a microwave. We would like an armored personnel carrier. We would like rocket launchers. We would like whatever. And simply for the request, you get them, period. So you have now fully militarized SWAT teams, which look, they're no different than...
Well, and now that they're asking for drones and getting them.
They're getting them. Now, the federal government is cooperating so that police departments can simply get them.
Yeah.
I saw one go over my house.
Oh.
I was standing there with 10 other people. And for the record, middle of the day, no alcohol or drugs involved. Anybody that knows me know I'm not really a drinker. I don't do any drugs. I don't smoke anything. I'm one of these straight-laced guys. And we're looking up in the sky, and somebody goes, what's that thing? And we're looking up, and it's a glint of metal. And as it comes closer and closer, and I'm like, no sound, fairly low altitude. It couldn't have been more than, I don't think it was more than 1,000 feet. It was pretty low. And as it flew by with no sound whatsoever, literally over my house, and we're standing outside, and we look up at it, and I'm like, you got to be shitting me. That's a drone.
Oh.
And I told it to people, you know, and I live in New Hampshire, USA, so for those of you outside the country, look it up. And I told it to folks. They said, oh, it had to be an A-10, you know, one of those tank killers that they have at the upstate New York, you know, base. And I'm like, I know what an A-10 looks like. A-10s are very loud. This thing made no noise. Okay.
Ooh.
So, and I know what a drone looks like, and I know what I saw, and that was what it was. Right. And everybody looked at me, and I looked at them, and I was like, you got to be shitting me. And they're like, yeah, we saw it too. So,
wow.
There are
how far, Steve, how far are you from, like, a large city?
Well, I'm pretty tucked away, but I can get to Boston in 2 hours, and I can get to...
Okay, so why would a drone... See, that's it, you know, because I live in a small town, and I don't have any big cities near, and I haven't seen anything here, but, that is just... Well, we know they're around. You know, people keep telling me, well, those are all unarmed. But you know what it takes to arm one? Not much, I hear.
No, it doesn't take much. It doesn't take much. And nobody has to fly it. All the fuel goes for the lightweight, you know, fuselage. Mm-hmm. No human beings involved. Once you remove the human being from the item, the craft that's in the sky, things change dramatically.
Right.
You don't need much thrust. You don't need as much room. You don't have to have anything that provides heat or oxygen or any of those things, ejector systems. It's all taken care of by some guy with a joystick in Santa Clara, California.
That is horrible because, you know, we have people in Nevada and New York who are manning the drones in other countries, killing all these people. It's a game for them.
And I've had this discussion with people who have served our country, and, you know, and of course we are thankful that they put themselves in harm's way for us, and it sounds like a very trite statement, but let's just examine that for a moment. We are saying that they would step up like that. We don't like what some of the things they're made to do any more than they do, but we're thankful that they're at least willing to serve in some way, and it doesn't mean that they are part of the foreign policy. They're simply...
They're
in a position, and they have to do what they're told. So
I think they can serve by staying in this country because those people out there haven't done anything to me. If somebody comes over here, sure.
Yeah.
But
we'll
be going,
Well, I mean, look, you know, two different people in the country, in the world, that we know about that have addressed this quite a bit. And one of them is Howard Zinn, who, of course, has passed on. And
right.
He was a wonderful man. And the other one is Noam Chomsky. And also, he's still with us. And he also is a wonderful man. Now, both of these men have been described as, anarchists and so forth. But I'll tell you what they really are. Anarchist doesn't mean what you think it means, necessarily. When people hear the word anarchist, they think, guy with a machine gun running around in the street with a bunch of other guys with machine guns, and there's no law, there's complete lawlessness, and you have what you see, like, in, you know, in Somalia or West Africa. Well, I suppose that is a form of anarchy. But true anarchy has a definition, and the definition is the recognition within oneself to realize that you can govern yourself quite well, that you realize, in fact, external governance for rational, reasonable people is really not necessary. And so the argument can be made, well, what about the people that aren't rational and aren't reasonable who, for whatever reason, they pick up a gun and they say, give me your money, bitch, you know. So certainly there are people that need to be governed because they've proven that they can't do it themselves. But for those that can, there are those that really resent that authoritarian form of any government over them. Those are what we would consider to be anarchists. And when they make those points, they're often usually drowned out by, you know, being shouted down by those that think it's just, you know, that's just crazy talk, when in fact it needs to be explored more. Because those people are generally the people that say, you know, there's hope for us. There's hope for us. We don't have to be afraid. It's about hope. It's about what we can achieve. It's not about how we failed. It's about what we can do if you are willing to roll up your sleeves and do the hard work of not being an asshole.
Yeah,
not being an asshole is sometimes very difficult for people, but you got to try. So, I mean, you know, and then you realize that what do we have to fear? It's just like that old saying, you know, the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. It's really true.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, there are things that go bump in the night. There are bad people who will come and who will try to do this, that, and the other thing. And you do have to draw the line. However, as true as that may be, it isn't a rule to live your life by day to day.
Right. Yes. I have friends who are so afraid to speak out about anything.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I've had this conversation before, and I've talked about it on the air. Like, you alluded to this earlier in this broadcast tonight, and that is that when you approach a police officer on the street now, because of all the things you've seen happen with Occupy Wall Street and all these things that have to do with the culture of fear and the way that the police are you know, apparently operating from a standpoint of, you know, uber safety for them, which born of fear, born of the fear of them getting hurt or whatever. And I don't blame them necessarily, but we all have to take responsibility. And so now we take the chance. We take the chance of, okay, when you approach a police officer in the street, you're taking a chance. All you want to do is say, hey, how do I get to Route 16? How do I get to, you know, Interstate 495 or whatever? You don't know how that's going to go.
Yeah.
You could have bitten off a lot more than you could chew, depending on which police officer you happen to, you know, engage.
Right. What kind of run he's just been on, and how pumped up he is, or whatever.
How pumped up he is, right? And what's his career been like? What's his day been like? And because of that day that he's having, what's his home life like now? Because of, you can't just not take it home. That's foolish. You know you're not taking it home. It's going to come out in your life. So what's happening to your personal life? How hard is it to be a police officer? Well, I tell you what, it's damn hard. Okay, just like it's damn hard to be a soldier. You see all these horrible things happen that are pointed out that, you know, American soldiers, just like soldiers of any other country, let's face it, they're shown to, you know, just lose it and do these horrible things, you know, like urinating on the bodies of your enemies. You know, knowing so well that you're really insulting people's, you know, religious tenets by doing that, or you're, you know, it's the ultimate in disrespect, or this, that, and the other thing. We see all these horrible things people do, and these are normal people. These are normal people, just like when they do the studies on what made the SS do what they did, especially at the camps. And then you look into the situation very deeply, and you take time and look at the situation, and you see that these were normal people who had dinner. They had conversations. They had support scores. They wanted to know how the stock exchange was doing. They, you know, all the stuff they were talking about. Their mother's favorite, you know, strudel or whatever the hell it is that they really like to eat.
Yeah, that's what
then
you
the tell
people. You know, they
just
had
go back to work and kill
families
people.
That love them. They had dogs that love them. Kids that
absolutely
love them.
Absolutely.
Sure.
Yeah, and to them it was a job. The psychology was at work. There was fear. You're taught how to fear people.
Well, and any time, and armies around the world do it, they teach the people, just by the chance and everything they do when they're working out and all this, I know I have a friend who's part Arab, and he was in the Marine Corps for this country. Mm-hmm. And it was sort of difficult because part of the thing was they were talking about those little brown guys and the raghead, and they just put into you that these people that you're going to be encountering are less than you. They're less than human.
Right.
And, you know, I mean, that is drilled. And
I have dealt extensively with people that I liked very much, who had been, you know, in combat for real and had been there more than once. And they had come away, these particular individuals. Now, this is not a paintbrush you can paint everyone with, but, you know, these are certain particular individuals because this is the subject we're on. So I don't mean to imply that all soldiers are this way, because it's not true. But these particular individuals, they really felt that, and these were white men in the United States, they felt that men of color, like black men or Indian men, or, and by Indian I mean from India, or, you know, Asian men, that they were subhuman.
Yeah.
And they firmly, firmly believed it to be the truth. They really didn't. It wasn't an affectation, you know, like they would say things like, it's not the niggers. No, they really believed it, like for real, like that there was some genetic basis for the fact that these were not really human beings. They were almost human.
So they weren't worthy of the respect of.
Did that come from their time being indoctrinated in the service, or were they that way before?
In at least one case, it was, you know, there was a predisposition there because of the way they were raised. And so
okay.
the military
yeah.
simply, you know, enforced it during that period. But in the other two, it was very much the indoctrination and the psychology that you go through. Now, you've got to remember that when people encounter horrible situations, it affects your endocrine system. It affects all your nervous system, your psychology. You know, this is where PTSD comes from. This is where all these... This is how it affects them. And one of the things that affects them is that to survive the situation, they get immersed into this psychology.
Mm-hmm.
As you just mentioned a second ago, the psychology is that you are God and everybody else that is your enemy is shit and you will destroy them all. There is no let's reach terms. No, you're going to destroy them all.
Yeah.
Where do you think
religion comes in? I want to say to people just joining us, I'm speaking with Steve McManus from ForbiddenAmerica.com radio show, and he's talking about using fear to control society and seeing things for what they are. So
right.
How do you think, Steve, that religion or spiritual paths fit into this?
You will often find that when you have people that will band together for whatever reason. Now, with religion comes a certain social adherence, you know, like, for instance, it isn't merely that you have a common set of tenets to your religion, but you also have a certain social interaction that creates a kind of a community because it's a religion. Now, let's, you know, remember that religions are invented and administered by humans. They have nothing to do with deity. The deities could give a shit about your religion. They don't care.
Right. Right.
And there are people listening to this that will go, they'll be offended by that comment. And frankly, I don't care. But they don't care about your religion. They don't give a shit, okay? A deity is a deity, and if you believe in deity, then you also realize that the deity is, you know, so much more omnipresent than that, that the religion means nothing. It's simply a tool for you, the human, to get into a headspace that allows you to focus and keep, you know, focused on the communication with deity of choice. So, and then even then, people will say, "Well, I'm offended by that. There's only one deity, and it's mine. It's not a deity of choice. There's only one." Well, you know what? That's fine. Go ahead with that. But here's the point. The point is that in religion, you have that paradigm where you have all these people that think this is the only reality, and all the other realities are horseshit. Okay, and because we're the only ones that are right, everyone else is wrong, and they're being taught because of their doctrine to believe wholeheartedly, and in fact, they will even go so far as to say, "I don't believe it, I know it," that what we're being taught is the only truth, and this is what they're taught. They're taught, and that's a very short step from xenophobia, so the fear of anything foreign to you. So we were made in the image and likeness of God, and since we are the only people that feel and believe this way, people that feel and believe a different way are not in the image and likeness of God, and therefore they're shit, worthy of destruction. So now you're being taught things like superiority, inferiority. You're being taught things like misogyny, where women have their place, and you better shut up and sit down and only do what I tell you to do. I don't want your opinion. All of these types of psychologies come into play very quickly. Now, there are people that will be listening to this program and say, well, now, wait a minute. Religion can be a very wholesome and uplifting thing, and it doesn't mean that everybody that follows a religion is an asshole that thinks that women are less.
Oh, that's for sure, yes.
Their color are less, and so on and so forth. You know what? That's true. You will meet people, good people of every religion. I've met people in different flavors of Satanism who were good people.
Yep,
people are going to lose their minds when they hear that one. but, I mean, any religion, you're going to have good people involved, and then you're going to have people that are zealots who cannot entertain anything outside of their own sphere of what they consider to be reality. They will not even consider an alternative. And that's where fear comes in, because once you're confronted with things that don't fit into that paradigm, then you have no choice but to be afraid of it, because in order to even entertain
interaction with it or entertain dialogue with it or even entertain the concept of looking at it as existing and having validity, then you are now in danger of saying that everything you believe, at least you've been taught to think this way, that everything you believe is invalid. Now, of course, that's not true. And there are people that have been, that have evolved a little bit spiritually know that simply because you like to believe one way and you have a certain thing that works for you doesn't mean that something different that works for someone else is invalid, that if it works for them, then go for it. And there are people that can't get there. And that's really at the crux of what some of this fear is about. Religion does play into that. People's religious tenets do allow for a bleed over. I mean, the Southern Poverty Law Center goes into this at great length. There are some twisted, considerations that come up with regard to religion. And, just look at any study of the KKK, and you'll see that. There's some twisted sons of bitches out there who really think that, Jesus was a white man. He wasn't even Jewish. He was a white man. I mean, really? And you cannot disprove that to them. They will not even hear about it. They will not even entertain the facts. They simply believe what they believe. And if you continue to challenge their viewpoint, they'll kill you.
Yeah.
I mean, they'll kill you.
Yeah, for real. Serious to them. And that's it. But those are the people, among people, that really terrify me, the ones whose minds are so closed. Who think that their way is the only way. And so if you don't believe that, you really don't deserve to live. So then they're not going to be there for you when you need someone. They scare me.
In recent years, in the last 5 to 8 years, we have seen a record number of U.S. senators quitting their senatorial office because they can't take it anymore. They can't take the fact that there's no compromise. There's no ability even to make a discussion without making it personal and without making it, ripping someone's guts out on a very personal, very emotional, very dog-eat-dog level. And the old school guys are like, and women are like, this isn't the Senate I signed into. This was the place where you could go and have any discussion. And even if you didn't agree, you realize you were there for the people and you tried to compromise on what would be best for the people. You win some, lose some, but you try your best to do what's right for the people. That's keeping your eye on the ball. Well, now there's so many people that can't hack it in there anymore because it isn't that way anymore. It's dog eat dog. And you leftist, communist, socialist, sons of bitches on the Democratic Party, we will kill you. I mean, it's almost come to that point.
Where
people are afraid to even have a discussion because there is no compromise. It's all based on fear. And, then they run the machine. They crank up the machine and they say, well, if you elect them, this is going to happen. And they lie. They'll do whatever they got to do to keep you afraid to get that vote because it's business as usual. And they want to make sure that business is conducted. And if your vote is required to make that business machine run, they will use your fear to get it done.
Yeah.
And that is reprehensible. That is freaking reprehensible that they do that.
It is. But you said, in the past few years, we've just seen that over and over. And, some of us can't remember when it wasn't quite that way.
Right.
We had faith in the people we sent. And like you said, it was win some, lose some. And, of course, they'd fight and on. But this conservative bent, this my way or the highway, not only that, just my way, is a little much. So, I think that we're getting it from all sides. But it seems like the government, a lot of us now no longer trust the government. So we're fearful of things that they have done behind our backs and fearful of things that they may do. Just like talking these people who are in somewhat control.
I had a discussion 2 years ago. Now, this is 2 years ago, so keep that in mind. I had a discussion at a local town hall. Now, I'm tucked away, as I said, in the mountains of New Hampshire. This is a village. This is Norman Rockwell. I am not anywhere near asphalt, okay? I went down to the town hall, and I know the women behind the counter. I know their first names. It's like Otis, it's like Mayberry, RFD, everybody knows everybody's name. It's that kind of town, okay?
Right.
Despite that fact, okay, I went down there and I spoke to the lady who had run for town clerk and won, and she does a very good job, and very nice lady, very professional. And I asked her, because, you know, this is me, this is Steve. I mean, I'm the guy that's forbidden America, so these are the kind of questions I ask people right out there on the street.
Okay.
And I said, look, this new climate where people don't trust the government anymore at all, at it, you know, how bad is it at the local level? She said, it's horrible. She said, there are days when we just don't want to come to work because they see us, people come to the counter and they see us as the freaking enemy.
Wow.
And they treat us accordingly. Now, that's not right.
No.
They're just the same people. They're not bureaucrats. They're, you know, it's Jane and Sue and Brenda. You know, I'm making names up, but you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
These are the same people you knew a year ago. They're the same people you knew 6 months ago. They're not out to get you. You know, they're just stamping your paperwork so you can register your car and stuff like that, you know. And it's, but it doesn't matter. The climate has become so antagonistic and so much animosity and acrimony in it. A lot of A words there. They take it out on anything that has anything to do with any level of government, and that's fear-based. Because you got people that make good points, and then they do something like they establish the Tea Party.
Right.
Well, that's fine. If they establish the Tea Party, that's fine. They have every right to do that. And they have made some good points from within that party, and already people will say to themselves, they'll roll their eyes and go, oh, Jesus, here we go. The fact is they have made some good points. Problem is that they take the fear part of it and they run it up the flagpole, and the majority of what you see come out of the party is not useful to anybody. It's just more of that same crap that, you know, he doesn't have a birth certificate. You know what? That may be true. There may be something there to that, but you're couching it in all of this, can't have one of them nigs running the country, you know, all that bullshit.
Yeah.
You don't need it. Who's that helping, you know? It's a fear thing. You need to fear these guys because they're different from you. You need to fear them because they're up to no good. You know, they've ordered, you know, 100,000 or 100 million coffins. Who are they for? Well, the thing is, we don't know who they're for, and you've only got a little bit of information. Let's look into it more deeply. Let's get the details. Let's find out who they're for.
What is that all about? You know, there was a time when we thought that FEMA was a good organization, and now the only thing you ever hear, or the only thing I ever hear, is how they're all out to get us.
And I'm glad you brought that up, because I had a show on Forbidden America that
you're breaking up a little bit, Steve, I think. For me, you are.
How's this now? Better?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. We did a show not too long ago. Actually, I think it was the tail end. It was either the tail end of 2011 or it might have been the first part of 12, where we spoke with a guy who is a contractor and a consultant, and his job is to be one of the first people to hit the ground after an oh shit scenario. Like Katrina, he was there. Like Haiti, he was there. Like Fukushima, he was there, and so on. The day after, he's there at every location. And he's not a government employee, he's a contractor. And his job is to show up with his team of like four or five guys, the TV show in the making, I'm telling you. And he goes ahead and he...
Could you do whatever you did a while ago when it stopped breaking?
Right. Is this better?
No.
No? Okay, hang on. I'll make it better. How's that?
Okay, maybe I'm the only one that it's breaking up on.
Hang on. Okay, how are we doing now?
Oh, now that sounds much better.
Okay, yeah, I'm in a different part of the building. So, basically... He ends up on the ground, you know, and he takes his team and they establish emergency communications, like a satellite dish that has its own power so the mayor can communicate with the world, you know, and then they find out who the commanders are of the different, you know, militarized police units, and they make sure that everybody knows who they are so they don't get shot, that type of stuff. And then they get on the satellite phone and they try to coordinate getting airplanes on the tarmac with food. You know, they just coordinate the whole thing. That's what he does.
Right.
And he keeps his head. People are around him screaming and, you know, body parts and, you know, blah, blah, blah. There's a really bad scenario, but you need people that, you know, for lack of a better way of putting it, they're at home there. And they know they're not at home because they like it. They're at home because they do well with the stress. They keep their head and they keep their eye on the ball. So everybody else is freaking out, perhaps rightly so, but this guy is getting it done. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, and he talks about the FEMA camps, and he said, he says, I've built six of them. I built them. I said, okay. And he says, and I can tell you right now, they're not for, you know, carting, rounding all you guys up and carting you away. He says, because if they're going to cart you away, they're going to cart me away too.
Mm-hmm.
I said, four. He said, well, what we built them as and the things that are located inside of them are designed specifically for support for people working in a disaster zone and for people that are refugees from a disaster zone, to give you a place to take a shower, to give you a place to sit down or sleep, or to get, you know, a can of hot soup, that basic type of stuff that you just need a break. That's what those camps are for. He says they're not for detention. They're not for any of those things. And I said, how do you know? How can you assure me that that's not the government's intention? He says, because I've seen the documentation. I've seen the plans. They are not secret. You simply need to ask for them, and they will show you. So here's a guy that's worked the system. He's worked on the inside. He built the damn camps, you know. He did everything. I said, well, okay, so then, Ed, tell me this. Why are there guard towers? He goes, well, of course there's guard towers, because in an oh shit situation, you may have people that lose it. And how else are you going to defend the place if you don't have people up high that can see what's coming?
Mm-hmm.
So he says it's not about, you know, it looks like Hogan's Heroes, but really what it's about is, you know, it's a place to fall back. And so I made a half serious quip with him. I said, so what if it's a zombie apocalypse? It's like a fallback zone. And he started to laugh, and he said, yeah, if we had a zombie apocalypse, you'd fall back to the FEMA camp so you could at least have a gate around you, and then you could just get up in the tower and shoot him. I mean, he says, no need to be afraid. Just do what it takes. And so that was his whole, that's his whole thing in every situation. Don't be afraid. Do what it takes. So I think if more people in the country had that attitude, I don't need to be afraid. I just need to do what it takes. So when you have people that are protesting the 1% bankers, not because they're rich. No one's ever protested the fact that someone was rich, because that's bullshit. What they've protested is how they got rich and at whose expense and whether or not it was legal. Was
and what
legal,
they're doing now to get
and
rich.
And what they're doing now. Mm-hmm. And then when you question them on it, they get the goon squad, in some cases the public police, and then they'll crack heads just to shut you up. That is dead fucking wrong, okay? And that just contributes to the fear that they're acting from. It's like somebody that I know at the Witch's Voice Incorporated, which is a nonprofit educational institution with a very popular and very well put together website, WitchVox with a V.
Now, what's it called? Oh, WitchVox. Yeah, sure. Okay.
Yeah, WitchVox.com. I was told that as the people are forced to relinquish their power paradigm toward the end of this age, which is about to hit us, so there's an overlap. The years that have led up to right now and the years that will succeed from now, a few years on either side of it, there will be a phase of a loss of power by those that have had it and screwed everything up, and a gain of perspective and control by those who will not abuse it.
Mm-hmm.
And so when they are forced to relinquish that stranglehold, things are going to get ugly because they don't want to relinquish that stranglehold.
Well, they don't want to. It's like we're going through the dying throes now.
Right.
Of it. And that's no, right. It's not pretty. It's not going to be pretty for a little while, I think.
Yeah,
no.
That's right. So,
I'm fully optimistic about the other side of it.
Now, are there people, here's the question that you can ask next. You know, and I'm anticipating arguments from people that would otherwise be arguing with us right now, so I'm just going to save them the time. Are there people in the Occupy movement who don't get some parts of this right? Well, of course, there are people that lost their focus. There are people in Egypt, Syria, places like that, and Bahrain, and places like that, who didn't lose their focus. They knew that there was a very good chance that when they protested, they were going to catch a round in the head and get killed, and they did it anyway.
Yeah.
The reason they did it anyway is because it's that important. You know, our country, the United States, was founded on a conspiracy. How do you like that? They conspired to say, you know what, liberty and justice and equality actually mean something. and were willing to give our lives to prove it. And they conspired until they launched their plan, too late to go back at that point. And it was so important to them that they didn't even let Ben Franklin into the meetings because he couldn't keep his mouth shut. Even though he was a good guy, he didn't know how to shut up, so they wouldn't let him into the meetings. But it's
<That's>
true. But because he would always head down from the meetings, he'd immediately go to the bar and start knocking them back and talking to the bar wenches and just run his mouth, and they couldn't trust him that way. I cannot relate to that. But, you know, they were willing to give their lives for what was right. And it's no different than what they're doing in those countries where they have nothing left. They got nothing left to lose now. They've lost so much that they're like, you know what? We're going to protest, and hopefully there'll be some cameras, and hopefully the footage will get out, and hopefully people will take notice, and it will begin the change. So you had the Arab Spring, you know, and then you had Occupy, and then from Occupy you had these other movements, and so on and so forth. The bottom line is people are waking up. People are looking at each other and going, why am I afraid of you? I mean, why would I be afraid of you? And they're figuring it out, that they've been sold a bill of goods, that they've been told lies, and that they don't need to be afraid of everything. They don't need to be afraid of everyone. It's manufactured.
Well,
it's a big lie.
Right. They manufacture because they want that divisiveness between all of us.
That's exactly right.
We won't band together with Occupy or some other group and force their hand. But we're going to.
That's right.
So...
And once you see it for what it is, once you see it for what it is, what it really is, which is some bullshit is what it is.
Yeah.
And then you share that with other people in a reasoned tone. You don't get up on a stump and start ranting and raving about the government's a bunch of bullshit. You can't do that because you've lost them already.
Yeah.
But if you simply talk about the reality of the situation, when you look at the reality, like, you know, the people at town hall, they're not bad people. They're just doing their freaking job. My state senator, not a bad person. She's just doing her job. So what's her job? To listen to me. So get involved and get on the phone and talk to her office and make sure she understands that as a constituent, you have a concern about this, that, and the other thing. She can't do her job unless you do yours. Get involved. There's less to be afraid of if you take it into your own hands the right way and help create the country that you really deserve. If you let them do it for you, they're going to screw it up.
Right, and they aren't mind readers. So what you say is very true. It's very relevant. Call them. Like them.
Right. You know, and what Jefferson said is very true. You want a government that fears you. You don't want a government that you fear. That's what we have now.
Right.
You know what? We're getting the government we deserve because most people, apathy was very strong in the 70s and 80s and into the 90s. And because nobody thought they could make any difference. They didn't do anything.
Right.
And this is what we get. This is what we get.
And now, I mean, right now, they sit on the couch, watch that box, or, you know, whatever. And
exactly. Even if you're writing someone in, even if you're going there saying, I don't want Obama, I don't want Romney, I don't want Ron Paul, I want, you know, whoever.
Exactly.
Jill Stein, or whoever your person is. Write it in then go do it.
Well, right. That's my thing. I won't vote for any Republicans. But
I happen to think that a vote... The popular
vote
for the presidency is not
good. Well, I'm sorry, go ahead.
The popular vote, your vote, my vote, when it comes to electing the president of the United States, it doesn't matter because the Electoral College decides it. And supposedly it's so that the votes are, you know, they're tabulated evenly across the country so that California and New York don't decide everything. But the thing is, they don't decide everything anyway.
No, we need a lot of reform, and the Electoral College needs to be booted out. There's no.
I totally agree. Yeah, the Fed and the Electoral College, bye bye.
Yeah.
And you know what? But you know why they're both there, the Fed and the Electoral College, is so that rich white men can continue to be in control and get rich and screw you.
Yeah.
And that's bottom line. That is the bottom line. You don't need to be afraid of these guys. You just see it for what it is. You talk about it amongst yourselves. And then you figure out how you're going to deal with it within the system, work the system that was built by people with your best interests at heart, and make it work. You don't need to be afraid of anything. You can do anything if you set your mind to it and get together and do it. But you got to do it.
Right, but just like we were, just vote. Because, you know, if you don't vote, you're just showing that you're apathetic. I've had people say, well, I'm going to show them I'm not going to vote. Well, they don't want you to vote. So vote.
Right.
Even if you don't vote for one of those two that are both the same pretty much, you know, vote so they know that you do care and you are a voter, but you just don't
right.
like what they're doing.
Right.
That's right. So just to overcome the fears that we have, you would say just face it and talk to yourself about why you really don't need to be afraid of this and this and this. What's your last minute advice on this?
My last minute advice on this is really simple. You know, it really is. Simply look around as if you've never seen any of this stuff before. Look around. Do you know your neighbors? Do you not know them? Why don't you know them? They're your neighbors. Is it because you're afraid that if you know them and then you don't like them, you'll be stuck, you know, with a relationship or whatever? Do you know, who do you know in your town? How many people do you know in your town? Do you know your checkout person at your grocery store? Do you know this person, that person, the other person? If you don't know them, there's the problem. They want you isolated. And the more isolated you are, the more afraid you're going to be because you don't know. There's too much about people around you that you don't know. So you get to know them. You start a community. They know your name. You know their name. You know that they like, you know, mint chocolate chip ice cream. It doesn't have to be anything important. It just has to be something. And then, because you know it, then you start it. That's how you start a real revolution. That's how you say, everybody knows everybody in this town. And so we know that we've got each other's back. We don't have to agree, but we don't have to be afraid.
Right. Well, and you know what you just said? This is exactly what we've told people and how we have done it in, well, across the country, being pagan.
Yeah.
Just make sure that you don't hide it. And when
right.
people get to know you, then if somebody makes a remark about pagans, somebody else says, oh, no, you're wrong. Because so-and-so is my neighbor, my friend. You know, they're pagan,
yep.
and look what they do.
Yeah, that's right. You're not the crazy, weird cat lady down the street. You're actually Ruth Ann. And
well, I might be, but I'm still, yeah.
right. Doesn't watch TV and doesn't eat meat. What the hell's the matter with her?
She doesn't have a TV. She's got three cats. I don't know.
Yeah.
I think you have to have more than that to be the crazy cat lady, I think.
You're pretty much screwed.
yeah, well, you know, yeah, whatever. But
right.
oh, I mean, when you let people get to know who you are, then
right.
if they have some preconceived ideas, that changes in most
right.
cases.
I agree.
So, yeah. So we would say 10 o'clock Saturday night.
Saturday nights at 11 p.m. Eastern Time.
Yeah,
that's
I'm sorry, because it's 10 here. Yes, 10 Central. Eastern, 11 o'clock, Forbidden
right.
America. And
with
Steve has great guests on.
I sure do. In fact, this weekend we're going to be talking to the survival mom, and
mm-hmm.
she talks about if you are the head of a household or the mom in a household, and there's an oh shit scenario. Are you prepared as the mom? Do you have your ducks in a row to help your family deal with whatever's happening? Pretty, good advice. And the other one that we're going to have next week is I'm going to be doing a live interview with Stanton Friedman in person. He's the number one ufologist in the country. In fact, he was the first civilian investigator at Roswell when it happened.
That's going to be really good. As you know,
phenomenal. He's a great man.
Yeah. Well, Steve, thank you so much for coming on, and I look forward to having you again.
I do, too. You want to go to ForbiddenAmerica.com. You also want to go to TruthIsScary.com for Joseph Peterson's site. And you also want to come back here to Era Marfeo, and you want to make sure that
yeah.
you keep listening to the show because she does good work.
Just keep coming around. And we will see you, my friend, soon.
And
thank you.
I thank you for having me on. We'll talk to you later.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
welcome to the second half of Your Head. You're listening to Broccoli Samurai from Cleveland, Ohio. My guest in this hour is Morgan Thomas Jones. And Morgan is house expert on polyamory. So, hi, Morgan.
Hello. I wouldn't say I'm an expert.
Well, you seem to know plenty and be involved. So,
well, thank
being
you.
Involved.
Thank you.
Yeah. You know, everybody seems to know what polygamy is.
Right.
For whatever reason, that guy's, he's got more than one wife, so he's a polygamist. And then you'll come to a lot of people, some know what polyandry is, or a woman with more than one husband. But then we'll say, oh, I'm a polyamorous, or I practice polyamory. And people go, huh? What's that? So, would you just give us a good definition? I know it would be good.
Well, first off, I want to go ahead and kind of draw a separation between polyamory and polygamy and polyandry. Polygamy and polyandry are more religious structure enforced. Polyamory is the belief that the human heart is large enough to love more than one person. It recognizes that human within us that loves. And, I mean, we all have multiple loves in our lives, whether they're romantic or not. We love all of our children. We love our parents. We love our brothers and sisters. And it's all varying degrees. And as a polyamorous, I recognize the fact that I can have very similar, strong romantic connections and maintain multiple relationships simultaneously through honesty and communication.
Mm-hmm. And which is, that's an excellent definition. But then you'll get these people to say, oh, you're a swinger. Is that it?
No.
You know, we're talking relationships here.
Right, exactly. And polyamory doesn't necessarily mean sex. It means love. Now, sometimes sex goes along with that, but it's not an automatic thing. And it's as much a acknowledgement of the ability to make more than one connection and be honest about it. And not live our lives as serial monogamous.
Then the cheating comes in. Because I've noticed, I'm sure it's probably the same with women, but I've just noticed with men, some men are pretty uncomfortable with the whole idea. They're more comfortable, believe it or not, with flat-out cheating. They would rather be with somebody and have her, in this case me, actually cheat on them, but them not know about it, or them cheat on me, then accept and deal with and communicate and work polyamory.
Well,
have you been into that?
Well, I would say a lot of that, from what I've seen, and like I said, I've not done any studies or any research on it, but from the examples I've seen, more often than not, it is a compulsion to adhere to societal norms at a surface level and ignore that what you know is right in your heart and sneak to do it.
Mm-hmm.
You maintain a face because you have this image of what a relationship is supposed to be, or how a dad's supposed to be, or a boyfriend's supposed to be, or a girlfriend's supposed to be. And or a mom, and we have all these preconceived notions of what that role is restricted to and what you can and cannot do if you're going to be in that role. And a lot of that is crap, honestly.
Right. And a lot of it is what, like, people fear what it looks like. I mean, they want it to look a certain way.
Exactly. They don't want to look different. They don't want to appear as someone who's not a part of the herd. And that's the thing. The human species, while, yes, very tribally oriented, very herd-oriented, it's also very individualistic. And if not for the individuals breaking off, then the herd doesn't ever change the direction.
Mm-hmm.
So,
how did you first get involved in this or start thinking about it or whatever?
Well, I'm 45 years old, and I can remember back when I was a teenager, I always had multiple girlfriends, multiple girls I was dating. However, at the same time, I wasn't hiding it. It was a quote-unquote open relationship. However, more often than not, I would date friends who would go, okay, well, I care a lot about you. I care a lot about her, so I'm okay with you going out with her and you guys going to the movies or whatever. And I've always maintained multiple, well, not always. There's been some really bad, dark times for me. but there have been, for the most part, for the majority of my life, I have maintained multiple honest, open relationships, and it was a matter of coming to find out that the name that was given to living that type of lifestyle was polyamory. I found the name polyamory well after I was already that way.
Okay.
And I know, so it's kind of odd, but my life's been odd.
That's
so
nice. I mean, as much as we don't like to be categorized, sometimes we do like it when, oh, there's a name for what I am.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay.
And it gives a little bit of, I mean, yes, I always expected my... It's funny, as unique individuals, we always like to find the people who are unique just like us.
Exactly.
And it's that identification, and it was almost a, for me, it was a matter of, this is how I'm wired. I am wired to maintain multiple emotional connections simultaneously. I am not wired, however, to lie about it.
Right.
Personally, I think lying is way too much work, and
mm-hmm.
there's way too many details to remember, and I really don't have the time or energy to waste on it.
No, I totally agree. It's leading two or more lives is, it's frustrating. It uses so much energy.
It's ridiculous.
And you don't feel right because you're lying.
Exactly. You're not getting the full amount of joy that you could get from that relationship because you can't share it with everybody.
Right.
You can't be as happy openly as you can or as you could.
Right.
So, I mean, for me, that's one of the nice things. I can be openly affectionate with multiple people, and I get a strange look. Okay, whatever. This is my life. I don't hide. I'm actually kind of vocal, and I do my best to help other people network and connect and get some resources.
Didn't you start a meetup group or something?
Well, I am the organizer for the Indie Pagan, or I'm sorry, the Indie Poly Meetup.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, right now it's Indie Pagan Pride Daytime, and my brain kind of is wired that way. But I restarted the Indie Poly Meetup a few years ago. When Meetup changed to a pay format, nobody in the area could afford it. And as a birthday present for my at that time girlfriend, I went ahead and paid for the meetup to restart because we needed it. I was part of a working triad and we wanted to find other folks to resource and network with.
Right.
And that was the best way to do it, was to make it happen. And so we did. And she left about a year after that, and there was a slight explosion. Everything shifted, and now it's still going. I'm still happy, and I'm still poly.
Okay. So, no, I didn't realize that about the cost, I guess. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
They charge like $70 every 6 months.
Ah, okay.
So we take collections and everybody pitches in, but you have to have that person that's when they go, okay, I'll plop down $72 and see if I can get other people to come out and help.
Right.
And that's what it takes sometimes.
So, and now you do have a child. I shouldn't call him a child. He's still a kid, isn't he?
He's 17.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's a junior in high school.
Okay. So, and he's been raised this way, so he really doesn't, personally, he doesn't know a different way then.
Not well, he's had very short stints where he was parented by me and one other person, or just me. And I've been separated from his mom for over 10 years. We've been divorced for 10 years. And he primarily stays with me. And for the most part, I mean, he's grown up in a tribal atmosphere. And it's funny because my current primary was talking to him one day. And she's like, so be honest with me. Which do you like better? Do you like it better when it was just me and your dad? Or do you like it better when it's your dad, me, and other people, or when there's a lot of adults and stuff? He's like, honestly, I'd prefer it when there's a lot of adults, because if dad's busy and you're busy, I've still got somebody to go to.
Right.
I mean, my poly family is fantastic and awesome, and everybody works together to make sure that everybody is as successful as we can be, and everybody works together because to help make sure that my son gets what he needs, because he comes first.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah. Well, and like you've told me that if there was a potential person potentially going to be in your life, I mean, one of the prime concerns is how this person reacts to your son, because your
exactly.
son is. So you're not going to have somebody around who's going to not take care of him and have
no,
his
not at all.
Well-being in their heart. So
Exactly.
Has that been a problem with other people that you know?
It has. Mm-hmm. I mean, in some cases, you get the, and this may sound horrible, and please don't call in and tell me I'm an asshole for saying this. I'm sorry. But you have the quote-unquote step-parent syndrome, where it's not their kid, and they love the adult, not the kid, and the kid's more of a bother than anything.
Right.
And I'm sorry, but my kid's mini-me. If you can't love my kid, then you don't love me.
Yeah, well, right. I mean, you know, he's part of you. And, you know, and I've heard people say, well, you know, at least thank God, you know, the kid's 20 or 21 and doesn't live at home. It's like, well, okay, that's nice, but you still need a relationship with the child. I mean, you still need to, you know, because they're still the kid, and they're always going to be.
They're always going to be a part of that.
Yeah. How did you, if it's not too personal, how did you find the women that you're with now?
Oh,
How did you come together?
Some of them found me. I found some of them. I met my girlfriend that lives with me, Mishi, on OkCupid. I've met people on Yahoo groups. Back when it was Yahoo Clubs, I mean, through the pagan community, through the poly community, through other alternative lifestyle communities in Indianapolis. And you find people you connect with, your friends and stuff. So
it sounds like Indianapolis, where you live, actually has quite a bit in the way of resources, maybe?
Alternative
community, the poly meetup, maybe not. How big is Indianapolis?
Indianapolis metro area is about 1 million people.
Okay.
So we're, what, a third or quarter of the size of Chicago.
Yeah. So that's pretty big, though. I mean, there's quite a few people in the pool, right?
Yeah. I mean, we've got a fairly good sized metro community. And the funny thing is, we're very strongly in the Bible Belt. And it's a very conservative area. However, there's also a lot of us who aren't quite so conservative. And we've actually managed to network fairly tightly.
And I wanted to ask, because you're also the organizer for the Indianapolis Pagan Pride Day.
Yeah.
And what kind of a crossover do you see with the pagan community and the poly community?
Honestly, and actually, just for a minute, I want to be proud of myself. I just found out, it was actually confirmed for me today, that last year we had the third largest pagan pride day in the nation, which makes me pretty proud. New York City and Raleigh, North Carolina were larger than us.
Where, Raleigh, and where else?
New York City.
New York City, wow.
Yeah. They had 15,000 in New York City, but they're in Battery Park right there by the ferry, so they get a lot of walk-through traffic. Raleigh, North Carolina was 2,100, and we were 1,150.
Okay.
So, and then after us is Cleveland and Minneapolis.
Wow.
So, yeah,
excellent.
And we're going to be coming up here on September 22nd from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Sorry, I got to get the plugs in.
No, that's going to ask, yeah.
In Broadable Park in Indianapolis, like I said, third largest single-day pagan event in the United States. And we've got tons of vendors, belly dancers. We put on a giant feast where the community feeds itself and we share food. Information booths, networking. We've got open public rituals. And it's a really
information,
good.
Do you have an information booth for Polly?
No, actually, we don't have a... Currently, we don't have a booth signed up for the meetup because a lot of the people that are the organizers for the Poly meetup are actually the volunteers for Pagan Pride Day.
quite a bit of crossover there where you're concerned then, I'd say.
Well, a bunch of them are people that I've been good friends with for a long time and or are dating. So.
yeah. Okay. Hey.
It kind of helps. You call in the Poly family and go, okay, so we're going to do this.
Yeah.
It's going to be fun. But yeah, I mean, as for crossover, there is, you really can't call a percentage on it, because, I mean, polyamory, like I made the distinction earlier between polygamy and polyandry, it's not part of, quote unquote, the religious structure of the religion.
Right.
Or the culture. You're going to find polyamorous in every walks of life. I know some fairly conservative professor types that are poly. I know people that deal with healthcare that are poly, people that are in all kinds of different fields, all kinds of different interests. I mean, you got people that are poly going to the science fiction conventions and anime and cosplay stuff. You've got people who are poly going to the kinky stuff. I mean, you've got them going to the SCA. I mean, it's not really a correlation. It's you're going to find a percentage in the population.
I guess it's just for me because the people that I know personally and deal with are pagan, who are poly.
Absolutely.
And so, I know of people who aren't, but they're usually involved in something alternative, usually.
Right.
Seems so because they've already broken out of a mold, at least.
Exactly. They're generally involved in at least one subculture.
Yeah. No, I'd agree with that. What kind of horror stories? We like horror stories and success stories. So what kind of horror stories have you heard? or have you been accused of doing or being or something by people who don't understand?
Well, I mean, honestly, I don't really get a lot of guff from people about being poly. I don't talk about it at work because it doesn't really have anything to do with my ability to do my job or what I'm doing during the day. So I've actually been very lucky, I'm sure. I've always gone to movies, and either if I was part of a V and it was a male, female V, we both had our arms around her, or I kiss all of my girlfriends goodnight wherever I am. People don't approach me on it. Things are actually a lot more, people ignore the things that they don't want to see.
Yeah.
And, or if they have a problem with it, they haven't got the balls to come up and talk to me about it yet.
Right.
So, I mean, I've been fairly lucky in that. Because, I mean, I just don't really get confronted about it.
No.
I think it's because I don't act like there's anything wrong with it.
Well, that's it. And you're not trying to be in your face to get a response. You're just doing what you always do.
Exactly.
So,
exactly.
You know of any cases? I have to ask this because I've known of just people who were pagans, whether or not they were Wiccan, but who they've had to go to court to keep their kids and things like that. Have you known of any cases with poly parents who have faced something like that?
There have been a few. I can't cite any, but there have been some really nasty divorce cases.
Yeah.
Revolving around poly. I was fairly lucky in my divorce. In Indianapolis, when you get divorced, you have to go through what's called the Divorce Relationship Counseling Bureau. And after they did all their testing and all their analysis and everything, they saw absolutely nothing wrong with polyamory and saw that the benefit way outweighed what possible detractions were for my son. It's a larger support system.
Right.
And, I mean, it's the whole tribe raising a child, only
right.
Now we're
and
being honest about who's sleeping with who. Yeah.
Well, you didn't have some of those super conservative people against you because, the one-wayers or something. That would have not worked very well.
Yeah, I mean, the polyamory really didn't come up within my divorce as a huge issue. The judge tried to be snide and put in a codicil that my ex and I could not expose my son to anyone who was not a significant other, which means it's a little vague. It means I can't introduce him to a policeman because I'm not going to date a policeman. I can't introduce him to teachers only people I was dating I could introduce him to, but otherwise. So, yeah, we kind of ignored that.
Yeah, okay.
There's no way they could have pushed that one.
Right.
But, yeah.
Well, I guess that means that they didn't want you introducing him to a different woman every night.
Well, and that may be. However, that also means I can't introduce him to his teachers or our neighbors.
Right.
So.
So you've not had trouble with neighbors or anybody else?
Not really. But then again, like I said, I don't flaunt it, but I don't hide it.
Yeah.
It's part of my life. It's normal. It's natural.
Yeah. No, I think that's excellent. What do you think? Do you network, and network takes on all kinds of meanings, but with people in other states, in other parts of the country or world even? I mean, are there some types of organizations that...
There's not really any big organizations per se. There are advocacy groups, and that's pretty much the organization level that polyamory has, because you've got Loving More and you've got the Virginia Woodhull Foundation, and there's a couple others that are out there that are working for sexual advocacy and the right to love who you want. Now, something actually I found interesting was earlier today, I came across an article of a civil union that took place in Brazil about 3 months ago. That was between three people.
I missed that. Wow.
Yeah. And there's a hubbub about it, but the, and like I said, this happened down in Brazil, but the, not jurist, the lawyer, or the judge, Heather, they're living, no harm, they're all working to make sure that each other are taken care of in case of a separation or a divorce, I'm not a divorce, but a death. And he granted it. He married them. Or civil union men, we want to call it.
Wow.
So, yeah. And I personally think that's awesome. I mean, that's definitely a step in the right direction.
I think that is awesome. I mean, God, it just points out how far behind we are because different states are struggling for two people of the same sex to be married here.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
There, we've got a civil union of three people. Oh, my goodness. Oh, you made my
mouth. I mean, well, good. And it's awesome because, I mean, and that will bring into question the concept of international law and the recognition of marriages between countries.
Wow.
And, I mean, I think that's awesome for the people who want to get married. I have no interest in it, but I think that it would be awesome for the people that do want that, that do want that legal protection.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I have no, that's what I tell people when, you know, they are always, oh, why don't you get married? Why? It's like, man, been there, done that. No way.
Exactly. I have no interest.
You know, I, and for people who want a civil union or a marriage here, you know, my gay and lesbian friends, it's like, sure, you guys have a right to be just as unhappy as, you know, all these
know, right?
people.
Exactly.
It's fine. No, whatever.
Just don't make, don't drag me through it, okay? Yeah.
Exactly. Don't even. But but I mean, I think that for people who want to, definitely they should have the right. And so
exactly.
this
exactly.
really tickles me. Three people in a civil union. This is excellent. So yeah, like you said, that this is going to affect international law, then let's recognize. So good, good. You know, I should first say, if you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Morgan Thomas Jones, and he says he's not an expert, but he's the house expert. Polyamory. He's from Indianapolis, Indiana, and you can find him at www.pansdance.wordpress.org. It's a good website. Check it out.
It's pansdance.wordpress.com.
.com. I'm sorry.
You don't have to put the www on the front either.
Right.
But you'll get there.
Okay.
I
got there, and then I guess I don't know why I wrote it down just here as org, but okay, .com. And it is a good site. I got. So what about responsibilities? How, and I mean, I'm sure that this is just every group has their own. But is there something different in the relationship when you're having more than one at a time with people? Do you yourself talk to, usually you will have had one of these people in your lives and you bring somebody else in. So are there like ground rules that you find that you go over or not?
Well, that kind of situation depends on the relationship. From relationship to relationship, I came into my current relationship as poly, and so it set a different expectation. Instead of being part of a couple that was together for X amount of time before they decided to go poly,
right.
And in my case, it's a matter of if I intend to see somebody on a regular basis, then I'll probably go, hey, guys, this is what's going on.
Right.
Otherwise, all of the women I date can see my social calendar.
Mm-hmm.
It's back to that open and honest. And honestly, I don't know how I'd successfully do any of this without Google Calendar. It makes my life so much better.
Yeah.
But basically, everybody has the ability to see who I'm going out with on what night. And when somebody new comes in, the people that look and have a curiosity who they are, and generally there's not a lot of curiosity until somebody becomes more regular.
Mm-hmm.
Because a one-off date doesn't really mean a whole lot other than, hey, maybe let's go out and see how we click and talk and become friends and get to know each other. It doesn't necessarily mean that something's going to happen. It just means we're going to spend time together.
Right.
And it's more a matter of going, hey, this is what's going on. Honestly, I actually am very conscious about the women I start to see. I actually work very hard to pick women to date that are fairly compatible with each other.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least with part of the other girls. And that has to do with the fact that my version of a poly family is run very much on a give and take and a mutual respect. And like if somebody's having a bad day and it's somebody else's date night and something bad's going on, they're in the hospital or something, everybody is fairly easygoing about trading date nights to help everybody out. And part of that has to do with the fact that, yeah, they know that as a matter of mutual respect, that same opportunity or advantage or favor, however you want to put it, is going to be granted to them when they need it as well.
Exactly. So they'll have the comfort. Now, what about the women pretty much know each other. What about the other men that they see? I mean, how far out does this spread? Do they know each other? Do you know them? How does that work?
Well, it depends. The metamor level can be quite deep, but at the same time, I may meet them once in a dating the other person a year.
Yeah.
It all depends on where within that social circle they are, because not everybody I date is within my immediate see everybody social circle. Some of the people I date are from out of town.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't really have a lot of opportunity to meet their other. But, I mean, I know, let me think. Yeah, I have met pretty much all of my girlfriend's metamorphs.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm either friends with or at least on friendly terms. I mean, we can sit in the same room and sit at the same table. I mean, we may not be the best of friends, but we're not bitter enemies or anything.
Well, right. I mean, at least you have something in common. So, yeah,
right.
I mean, just like you're meeting any people that you meet, I mean, you're going to, some of them you're going to really like and others you're not. But
exactly.
The fact that they're with this person that you're with is not a reason to dislike them.
Exactly. And actually, I mean, for me, I actually like for the women I date to have other male interests.
Exactly, exactly. So that you are not the end-all and be-all. I think
exactly.
One thing that this teaches us is get over that ego thing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you've heard me say that before, that I because I used to be a firm serial monogamist, okay? And,
okay.
And I had friends who, of course, were pagan, who kept saying, come on, loosen up, you know, blah, blah. And, I mean, they didn't say loosen up, but they were just saying, well, you know, like, this is working for us. So when I finally got it, it was like, wow. And a lot changed in my head because I used to tell people, you know, just make a list of, you know, 25 things you want from a partner. And when you find a man or woman that brings 12 to 15 of those to the relationship, hey, consider yourself lucky. Grab on. You know, it's not
exactly.
Been getting better. But then when my head flipped around, it was like, well, shit, I've got 25 things. And if it takes three guys for me to get all of these things, then why not?
Exactly. And, in a lot of ways it comes down to, for me, polyamory is how I get all of my needs met and don't put all of the responsibility on one person to take care of all of those needs. I get something different from every single person I date.
Mm-hmm.
And simple. It's a completely different relationship with every single person.
Exactly.
And treating each of them as the same, or trying to force them to each be the same, or completely equal, or anything like that, is being very, very rude and disrespectful to each person's individuality and each relationship's individuality.
Well, it is, because then you're trying to put it back in that mold again. And
absolutely.
The thing is, like, you're getting something different from everyone, and they're getting something different from you that you're not giving everybody else, because
you got it.
It works. That really works well. And I've had a couple women say, I don't want to. I mean, the first thing is, I don't want to share him, and they're thinking sexually or something. And I remember something that Oberon Zell said one time at a workshop, I guess we were sitting around the fire. Anyway, because he said, I love it when I'm giving a workshop and I can look around and see all these lovers of mine. He said, I feel so loved.
Absolutely.
And that, what a wonderful feeling. Yeah.
And actually, just as a side note, Oberon Zell is going to be at a festival down at our haven.
Yes, he is. We'll talk about that a little bit.
Yes, September 14th through the 16th, called Circle Quest. So, giving a shout out for my friends that are running that event.
Yeah. And our haven, tell us a little bit about our haven. This southwestern Indiana.
Yes, it's southwestern Indiana. It's about 10 miles west of French Lick, Indiana. 187-acre nature sanctuary, open to all positive paths. Very specifically, they are very poly and or alternative lifestyle and pagan friendly. There's probably, I think there was 12 different festivals there this year. I am the organizer for Horn and Honey, which is a festival devoted to the horn god and earth and fertility goddesses. And I'm also the organizer for Labor Day Libertine, which is a alternative sexuality, sacred sexuality, and alternative spirituality, as well as poly and kink and BDSM-oriented festival. Where we have
right, so you're just home from that. Yeah.
Yeah, that ended Monday.
So how did it go? I know it had to be.
It was the best one ever. It was absolutely the best one ever. We had the biggest attendance. It rained the whole weekend, and we still had more people than we'd ever have come through the gate for that festival.
Sometimes
it was just a really great time.
Good thing. Yeah.
Well, and we were able to keep everybody dry, and everybody was happy, and we had really good time. We danced around the fire, and we drummed, and we celebrated life, and we shared knowledge and experience, and it was a beautiful thing.
Yeah. So you're going to be organizing that next Labor Day also?
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I will be doing Horn and Honey and Labor Day Libertine next year as well.
So, Horn and Honey is when?
Horn and Honey will be the last weekend of June. I believe it's June 28th through the 30th.
You organize a lot of things. So you really keep busy, and you've got your finger on this particular. I mean, not that you only do this, but really you're doing a lot for the poly community and the pagan community.
I do what I can. For me, it's a matter of paying forward.
Mm-hmm.
I've had a lot of people that have been very awesome to me and helped me in many, many ways, and I do everything I can to help people find what they're looking for. And if it's one of these areas that I'm promoting and helping and doing my best to help educate and network, all the better. That's kind of my philosophy on it.
Yeah. Well, it's something that you've been called to do. So.
Absolutely. I mean, I've been very lucky in my life. I've had a lot of grassroots organization training. I was political most of my life, political science, and I went to some really great grassroots organization conferences when I was much younger. I've been involved in politics through the Democratic Party off and on throughout the years. And it's all trying to get people where they need to be and helping them get what they see as best for them.
Well, you mentioned the Democratic Party. Have you been involved in that in this now? Are you involved in it?
No, I'm not. I don't have time.
Okay. Yeah.
I think that there would be a general rebellion among the girls if I started getting into something else.
Okay. One more thing. Huh?
Exactly. Exactly.
I don't know if you know who he is. His name is Victor Liebereck. I think Liebereck from Germany.
Yeah.
And he has called Polly, because he's very big on this over there, and he's online too, because of ethical non-monogamy.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think, well, that's good, because it is ethical. It's much more ethical than the people who are cheating and lying not only to their primary person, but to everybody else and themselves.
And actually, I was just about to hit on the key one, themselves. And that's really, and don't get me wrong, I do not advocate polyamory as the best relationship model for everybody on this planet.
No, everybody
has to
say.
It's very difficult. It takes a lot of self-honesty. It takes a lot of being able to cope with multiple situations, because with polyamory, you're taking the relationship issues that you have as monogamous couple and then multiplying it exponentially. Because when you start adding in other factors, you have to multiply for each person times each person, because everybody's going to interrelate in one way or another. And they're all going to affect each other. And they're all going to affect you. So, I mean, you have to be a lot more stringent and more steadfast about maintaining your sense of self, maintaining your self-honesty, and maintaining that inventory that is really necessary to grow and see where those burrs are on your soul and help file them down.
So, How do you personally do this? I mean, how do you keep focused and clear and true north? I mean, what are your own personal practices? And being a pagan, it may be different from some other people's, but do you meditate? What do you do?
Oh, as for spiritual, I do meditate. I lead public rituals. I have a group called Tribe of Salvo, Tribe of the Free. We have what we call revels, which are celebration and ecstatic celebrations of our love and the God's love for us. And then I'm one of those people that I'm in church 24/7. I'm constantly in a place of worship because the earth is what I worship, the trees outside, the grass under my feet. And the people next to me are all part of all the same. And so, I mean, that's part of it. And then I'm a recovering alcoholic, so I take very stringent self-inventory and look at my dealings with other people and my honesty level and what I'm bringing to the table and what I expect back. And honestly, you can't expect more than what somebody wants to give because, well, that's all you're going to get anyway.
Right. Yeah. That goes back to that non-attachment. I mean, you do the best you can. You send it out. And, I mean, you help somebody. You try. But it's very hard not to become attached to the result. But
absolutely.
But that's what you're saying. Yeah, you do what you can. And if somebody is just interested, now say that they live, you're in Indiana, I'm in Illinois, say they live in Nevada or somewhere, I mean, somebody, we don't know that many people there, they found out about this, they're interested in possibly finding someone in their area, What kind of advice do you have for them?
I would say if you're interested in finding other people to connect with on this level, if you're looking for specifically other people who are already polyamorous,
mm-hmm.
You can go to there's polyamory.org has some resources. There's a couple of fairly good polyamory groups on Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
There's some polyamory-oriented groups on Yahoo. There is, I can't remember the name of the site. Loving More has good information. I can't remember what the name. There's a website that's been around for years, but I can't remember the name of it at the moment. I apologize.
But there's a lot like that. What about? Are there a lot of meetup groups? Now you talked about that. Are there a lot of the ones that are formal meetup groups that pay the $72 every 6 months that you're aware of?
As far as I know, there are meetups throughout the nation. I know there's a very strong one down in Louisville. There's some out in Vegas, L.A., Seattle, San Francisco, Arizona, and Phoenix, throughout the South. And it's just a matter of getting on meetup.com or one of the polyamory-oriented
mm-hmm.
websites and looking for people that are advertising meet and greet.
That's
a good way to network.
Right. So our imaginary person, let's say they already have a partner,
okay.
But they want to explore this. Would you suggest that they talk to their partner about it, even though now say they're in a monogamous relationship and they both sworn fidelity, okay? But our person wants to try something extra. So would it be better for them to just go online and start looking, or to find somebody who was already in the life, or should they talk to their partner and, I hate this quote, try to convince them, unquote?
I think that the only way it's successful is through open, honest communication from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
If you're interested in it, then you just start being open to your partner fairly up front. Because it comes down to if that's who you are and that's how you want to live your life, then that if they love you, they need to love you. And they can't love all of you if you hold that part back.
Right. So that would be the first thing. And when you do that, you should also then recognize it could go either way. I mean, they may
absolutely.
Say, okay, we're done. Or they may say, hey, I've been wanting to step out of this for quite a while, and then that's going to hurt
right.
your ego too. And so you'll be prepared for that.
Right,
yeah.
And you have to be prepared to be fairly vigorous about. Last time I was on your show, I talked a little about jealousy.
Yeah.
And the fact that jealousy is a really good litmus test, depending on how you apply it for how things are going with yourself. As well as your relationship. We all bring garbage and baggage into each relationship from our prior relationships. Even if we've never had an actual one-on-one relationship, there's going to be other garbage and baggage that comes in anyway.
Sure.
And whenever you have those tinges of jealousy, you need to sit down and you stop for a moment and go, okay, so why is this bothering me? Am I not getting what I need? Compared to what I want, do I feel like I'm being left out? Am I having a pouty child moment?
Yeah.
Do I feel like I'm being disrespected? And if so, how am I being disrespected? Or is it just a gut reaction where it's like, but I wanted that.
Yeah.
And you have to be honest with yourself. And when you have those twinges, when you have those moments, you have to look and see why. And if it's an honest, valid, non-selfish thing, I mean, and non-selfish doesn't mean that it's not something that's going to hurt you. It means it's something that you're just kind of being greedy. and wanting to keep your toy all for your own.
Yeah.
And that's not positive. That's fairly negative human interaction on any level, whether it's in a romantic relationship, a business relationship, or a friendship.
Right. It seems like it's a control thing.
Very much. Very much. And you have to be willing to let go of that control and trust. And that's another one of the big pieces of poly that's hard for people. You have to trust and understand that just because that person is with somebody else doesn't mean they're not going to come home. There are cases where it happens. And I'll be honest about that. It happens. People change. People make different decisions. But at the same time, you have to be honest that if they really want to be with you, they'll be back. And they need to be honest with you, and you need to be honest with them about how you feel. But at the same time, you need to put on those big boy pants. And you have to own up to the fact that if you want something, then you should be willing to give it to somebody else. And just because you're not totally okay with it at this moment doesn't mean that you should necessarily deprive them of that.
Right. So it takes a lot more inward soul searching than people understand. And that's why I think it's so irritating when people say, oh, that's just swinging. And, you know, as far as this thing from, I mean, we're talking about real communication.
Oh, yeah. We're talking about lots of talking.
To ourselves. Do you think it's easier, I should say, would you again live with two women? I mean, you live with one and date others, but would you ever want to live with two?
Yes. As long as I have my own space.
Okay. Because, I mean, some people seem to do better, like you living with a primary partner and dating and loving other people, but not having them around all the time.
And I've been in all of those different types of situations. And this is what's working for me at the moment.
Yeah.
But as a rule, I mean, I don't see a problem. It all depends on the person. It's just like living with a roommate for an extent. You have to know whether you'll get along. There are some relationships I have that I think that if we ended up having to cohabitate, it would be okay. There'd be adjustments. There'd be some friction because of the normal adjustments that anybody has living with somebody else.
Sure.
And then whenever you've got more than one person, you're going to have more than one issue, and there's going to be dynamics between everybody. You've got to account for all that.
Yeah.
But there are some relationships that I can see that totally working, and with the acknowledgement that there's going to be growth pain, and there are some relationships that it just would never work.
Yeah.
So, and it all depends on the person and what they want out of life and what I want out of life. And for me, that's not really necessary for me to have a sustained relationship.
Not necessary to have a what kind of relationship?
A sustained relationship.
Oh, okay.
I mean, with one exception, I currently have five girlfriends. I have Mishi, who lives with me, and then I also date Miranda, Kellyanne, Anne, and Jennifer. Mm-hmm. And all the girls know each other. I've been with all of them for over a year. I have other, romantic relationships that we don't consider ourselves a label like girlfriend and boyfriend, but there is most definitely love.
Yeah.
And specific, even though she's in California, she's in my thoughts and my heart every day.
Yeah.
But we don't get to see each other. But we still communicate. We still maintain a relationship. Because what she needs is out there, and what I'm doing is here. So we make it work.
I think that's ideal. Because, I'm one of those people much better with long distance. And
yeah.
weekends and things than somebody around office time. So, but,
and all of my current relationships, like I said, have been going strong for well over a year now.
Yeah. So I mean, see that's working. I mean, you're all thriving, and your son's thriving. So.
And the longest term relationship out of those is 4 years. And after that, it's 3.5 and 3.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's taken a lot of work, but we've managed to make it grow and succeed and prosper.
Rich, just an aside, were these women who are also lovers and helping with pagan pride, et cetera, were they pagan when you got together?
Did
actually, you
bring
them in or what?
Well, okay, so that yes is kind of a fake answer, but it's a true answer to a point. actually, I do my best to not sway the spiritual path of anybody I'm involved with.
Okay.
In fact, I have a girlfriend two girlfriends that are very much exploring their spirituality, and they are very much headed down a pagan path. However, it is not with my assistance or guidance.
Mm-hmm.
Because, for one thing, that cheapens their growth. If
right.
Somebody
I mean,
can look and go, well, you're pagan because you're dating him, of course.
Yeah.
No, it doesn't work that way.
Yeah.
They're exploring their spirituality because that's what calls to them, not because I'm trying to influence them.
Yeah.
Because it's a path you have to decide to walk on your own. You can't be driven to it.
Really. And we've both seen groups that tried to do that. But
oh, absolutely.
Glad to hear that they're in it on their own. So it makes it more real and more important for everybody involved with that. But I'm going to have to let you go. I want to go over these all this information you gave us. Pansdance.wordpress.com.
Correct.
Right. And
yep.
The Circle Quest, you can probably just Google this. It's at our Haven on the 14th.
Yep.
And that's next weekend.
Yep.
Right. And then you will be doing Horn and Honey next June and Libertine Labor Day also. Those are at our Haven. So look up our Haven.
Yep.
Google that.
Absolutely.
And you can find out a lot. But you're
Darhaven.info.
Say that again?
Darhaven.info, I-N-F-O.
Oh, dot info. Okay.
Yep.
That's it. Right. And Indie Pagan Pride Day is September 22nd.
Absolutely. Come join us in Broderville Park in Indianapolis, September 22nd from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. We're going to have a hell of a feast. We fed almost 500 people last year. Everybody bring a dish to share, dessert or side dishes. Chocolate's always welcome. we grill
it,
and have a great time.
On the other show, but I didn't say chocolate welcome, so I'll say chocolate welcome the time.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. That's funny. So, well, thank you for coming by, Morgan, very much. And
thanks for having me.
Point. You made this lifestyle seem very normal, and it is for people who share it. So
it really is.
Yeah, it is. So thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. Have a good night.
Have a great weekend. Okay.
Peace.
Good night.
Bye-bye.